Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. My co-host Grace Wan is off for the night, but you'll hear her later on in the show interviewing 76-year-old snowboarding legend Dick Schulze about his amazing snowboarding career. We'll also be talking to Ariana Alex and Janae Cottrell about aging in the Bay Area and how to help seniors. But first, let's get an update on the war in Ukraine with Natalia Anyan. Natalia is the co-founder of Hromada, the only Ukrainian newspaper this side of the Mississippi. Founded in 2017, Hromada delivers news to some of the Bay Area's 20,000 Ukrainians. With Ukrainian reporters on the ground, Hromada offers readers a very unique perspective on the war that's going on right now in Ukraine. So welcome to State of the Bay, Natalia.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Great. Well, we're glad you can join us. So Natalia, let me ask you first just to tell us a bit about your paper, Hromada, and how it's uniquely poised to offer the information that it does on what's going on over in Ukraine right now.
Yes, we're the only Ukrainian newspaper that comes out monthly here on the West Coast of the United States. And the uniqueness of our perspective is that we really get information firsthand from Ukraine. Our reporters are from Ukraine. We have political, very important top political observers who write to our newspaper and have their columns. So, for example, just recently, I think just 3 hours ago, there are the first reports of possible use by Russia of chemical weapons on the city of Mariupol. This is being investigated right now. I haven't seen it on major U.S. media yet, but it's being looked into and it's being investigated. And if it's in fact, it was chemical weapons that were used, that's a major escalation. We have, you know, that in this war that the world should know about and steps should be taken. Just, you know, in addition to top political advisors, we have journalists who are there fighting in the war zones, and they are providing us firsthand information about the war. And I would say the different focus of our newspaper is from the coverage that you might have been seeing in the media is that media in the U.S. is focusing more on the soft, emotional side of the war, which is very important mm-hmm. and very troubling, right, as we hear about this. But what our newspaper and the coverage that we try to bring up to the to our readers and to the audience here in the U.S., what is needed right now? What does Ukraine need? What's the most pressing needs? And what could be done to stop this wild, bloody, barbaric war?
Mm-hmm. And how are you different? I mean, you mentioned that you don't focus so much on the emotional aspects, but how are you different from other newspaper outlets, other media outlets that have reporters on the ground there, but you say they're not giving the same story that you're able to give?
Well, you know, the messages, for example, that we send out, the most recent newspaper that came out on April 1, the headline on our newspaper is "Tanks, Planes, and Anti-Defense System for Ukraine," right? This is the most important. This is the most important thing that Ukraine needs right now. We just listened to President Zelensky in his daily address, and he's saying there is not nearly enough of this heavy weaponry that is given to Ukraine, right? We see the reports here in the media that the aid is given, and it makes us, and we all hope for it. We all want it, right? And it makes us feel good that something is being done. But then when you hear to the Ukrainian president, and when you also talk to the local activist, and this is what I have access to information, for example, I've just heard today from Maria Berlinsky, who's a very strong political activist who has all the latest information. And the message basically is Ukraine is not getting enough weapons that Ukraine was supposed to get yesterday. You know, in his address today, for example, President Zelensky said that if Ukraine had that weaponry that it's asking for, they would be able to deblock Mariupol. And you know the dire circumstances in which is Mariupol, where thousands of civilians are being under siege and are being blocked. And the Ukrainian soldiers who are there, the Ukrainian fighters, they, you know, they're in desperate need of weapons. They're running out of weapons, and that city is under siege. And it's even difficult to organize humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it seems like the U.S. is very much trying to help Ukraine as much as possible. I know there are some limits, for example, fighter jets, but it feels like there's no lack of will in the United States to help Ukraine and help Ukraine in its fight here against Russia. So what exactly is the holdup here? What would you like to see being done differently?
Well, you know, that's what we're all wondering. What is the holdup, right? Ukraine is fighting this war for the entire civilized free world. It's a battle of civilization. It's a historic battle, probably the most historic battle that we're going to witness in our life. So, you know, on one hand, we see the reports that, yes, a lot of being done in the media and weapons are being sent. But then on the other hand, you listen to the Ukrainian president. He's saying, no, we don't have nearly enough what we need to deblock Mariupol. This just happened in his daily address. Then you talk to activists, they're saying not enough. So is it the bureaucracy? Why is this happening? Why is this not moving faster if there is such a strong urgency? President Zelensky said you need to give us weapons faster because people are dying there on the ground. So I don't know who's in charge of making these decisions and how quickly they can mobilize these weapons. But you would think if the military involved and, you know, if these are military organizations, they would know how to mobilize. But the result is there is not nearly, apparently, there is not nearly enough weapons of this heavy weaponry. I'll just give you some examples as I just talked today to Maria Berlinsky. There's a specific list of weapons that Ukraine is asking for. Some of them are those very important air defense systems. So Ukraine apparently is asking for anti-defense system called Buk because it has a longer range, 50 to 100 kilometers, how it can shoot the targets. But they're giving instead Stingers, which is also, which I'll be very grateful. This is a good weaponry, but apparently it's portable. It's something that you can carry on your shoulder, and it has a much shorter range of 4 kilometers, right? Mm-hmm. And to win this war, to deblock Mariupol, which is in dire straits, you know, it's even ridiculous that as we talk in this time and age, something like this can be happening because daily civilians are dying in that city, right? Because of shortage of food, of water, and the Ukrainian soldiers who are there, they don't have enough weapons. They write these, video messages. If you listen to that, your heart breaks because these people know that they can die every minute. They don't have enough weapons. So, it's basically a plea for myself and my Ukrainian diaspora here to whoever's in charge of getting those weapons to Ukraine, that it happens, and it happens with more urgency because every minute, every hour counts. And it's not only the view of Ukrainian-American diaspora. I talk to so many Americans here, and they have the same feeling, like, how much longer can this go on? And, you know, why wasn't there was no fly zone that was approved? What else can be done? That this is going on for way too long. I believe today is day 47 of this, slaughter that we're witnessing, of this never again that we were saying since Second World War, and it's happening right now. And there needs to be an urgency in sending tanks. And I don't know why aircraft, why is such a taboo? You're saying, oh, we cannot send the fighter jets. Why not?
Yeah. Well, I know there's been some concern around with fighter jets specifically in a no-fly zone that, you know, potentially provoking a nuclear conflict. That seems to be the line from the U.S. And you talked about how long the war has gone on for. And, you know, in a lot of ways, it's really impressive what's happened on the Ukrainian side, because a lot of people were predicting that, you know, Kiev would be routed immediately. And it feels like the defense of Ukraine is actually doing pretty well, better than expected. And a lot of this fighting is now in the eastern region, as you mentioned. I'm wondering what you think is going to happen with potential peace negotiations. Do you anticipate that there could be a negotiated outcome to the fight so far, given that Russia appears to have been facing a lot of setbacks so far?
Well, you know, we all hope for that there will be some outcome to these peaceful talks. But, you know, as I listen, apparently the talks are going on. But, you know, after Bucha, after, I don't know whether you've seen the pictures of those atrocities of rapes of children, or women being raped in front of their children and parents, you know, it's you listen to the Ukrainian government. How do you carry on peaceful conflicts with the people who are war criminals? But you know, at the same time, it's a very, I think it will be a very tough line that the Ukrainian government and Ukrainian president will have to think about, because peaceful negotiation may mean, you know, saving thousands of lives. And that is what's at stake here. So we all hopeful that this will end soon, right? Because every day brings destruction and it brings more and more death of civilians and of Ukrainian, brave Ukrainian military, whom you mentioned, right? I think the whole free world is now in debt to the Ukrainian military that is being able to hold off and that blew such a powerful blow to the Russian army. But please remember that this is a battle of David versus Goliath. The Russian mm-hmm. army still greatly outnumbers, just by sheer numbers of the number of people in the Ukrainian army. So it's really the sheer spirit and knowing for what you're fighting, because Ukraine is fighting for its own survival, for its existence. Mm-hmm. The Russians' goal is to wipe out Ukraine in this fight, but it goes much further than that, right? Because, you know, it's really a war of civilizations. In delirious mm-hmm. Putin's mind, I think he claimed already several times that he thinks he fights U.S. in Ukraine because he considers Ukraine to be a U.S. puppet. So mm-hmm. It's really a fight for freedom. It's a fight, as Sean Penn was saying, it's a fight for the right to be free and to be able to mm-hmm. dream.
Yeah, and to keep your territorial borders intact, I think is definitely a principle at stake here for the rest of the world. Well, so what do you think would deter Russia at this point? It seems like they've faced some setbacks in fighting in Ukraine. You know, they did expect more, I think, than what they've gotten so far. There have been sanctions, you know, elevated sanctions, heightened sanctions put on the country. Do you think they're going to be deterred by any of what's happening internationally in terms of economic pressure?
There, of course, have been a barrage of sanctions already, right? But the most important sanction, the mother of all sanctions, which is full embargo on Russian oil, has not yet been implemented by the European Union. It has been done by the US, but not by EU, which is a major consumer of Russian mm-hmm. gas. Just to give you some perspective in numbers, since the war has started, European Union has spent $38 billion on buying Russian gas. This is since February 24th. And the European Union help to Ukraine has been only a fraction of that, about $350 million. And they, on March 23rd, they were going to increase it to $1 billion, right? So not all that money has even spent yet. So we're talking, 1-2% of the blood money that EU is sending to Russia for their gas has only 1% of that has been sent to Ukraine as humanitarian and military aid. So this is the mother of all sanctions, right? There was a fifth packet that was just recently implemented by EU, but it doesn't have the ban on Russian gas. And that I think that would cripple the Russian economy mm-hmm. because that's the major source of their income, and that yet to be implemented. And of course, what Ukraine needs right now, and I cannot stress it enough because I hear it from here from Ukrainian government, Ukrainian president, Ukrainian activists on the ground, is weapons, heavy artillery that has longer range, 50 to 100 kilometers, right? These mm-hmm. Multi-launch rocket systems, anti-defense system, planes, tanks. Yeah. You know, we don't understand why the free world is mm-hmm. so afraid of Putin. You know, all the moves are all just not to escalate, whereas they escalate each and every step. And, you know, if these reports are confirmed that, in fact, it was chemical weapons, right? It has yet to be confirmed. I caution it, right? I warn it because it has mm-hmm. to be confirmed. But if it was, in fact, chemical weapons that were used on Mariupol today, that is a major red line, right? We're not going mm-hmm. back now to Second World War. We're going to First World War, where the first the chemical weapons were used and since then banned.
Well, let me ask you, we just have another minute left here, but I know Hormada is not just a newspaper, but it's also a charity. And I just wanted to give you a chance to describe how the funds from Hromada is supporting Ukrainians right now. Can you describe a bit about your efforts?
Yes, absolutely. You know, since the war started, we reoriented all of our fundraising towards refugees and specifically women and children in Ukraine. And the way how we operate, we send these micro grants. So far, we have sent them to about 40 organizations, you know, 5,000, 10,000 here, 3,000 there. And the way how those funds are used, for example, we send them to one organization in Dnipro, they would load the trucks with food, water, supplies of first necessity and bring them to Kharkiv, to the city that was very heavily bombarded. They would give those supplies to the people who are there, then load these trucks with people, refugees, and bring them back to Dnipro. Another example, you know, there was children evacuated from Mariupol, orphans whose parents, some of them newly born in 2022, they were evacuated to Western Ukraine to one of the orphanages. And we sent the money, again, this mini graft of $10,000 to care for these children, and the list go on. You can see the full report on our homepage. I'll spell it: hromada.us, hromada.us. Hromada means community in Ukrainian, and there's a full listing. You know, we're very transparent whom we send the money, how we send the money. There's no overhead. We all volunteer based organization. Whatever money we collect, we don't sit on it overnight. We send it. We have a trusted network of charitable organizations and volunteers in Ukraine whom we trust from our prior dealings, and we put that money to good use immediately without any delay.
Well, so glad you mentioned the website, because I was going to ask how people can contribute. And I just want to thank you for all of your efforts to bring the story of what's happening in Ukraine here to us in the United States and to Ukrainians here, and for coming on the show as well. There's Natalia Anion, who's co-founder of Hromada, the only Ukrainian newspaper this side of the Mississippi. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you.
All right. And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to aging experts Ariana Alex and Janae Cottrell. That's right after the break. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be a part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about what it takes to grow old here in the Bay Area. Do you have older parents you're taking care of? What challenges are you facing? Have you started planning for your own golden years? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay. We'll be checking that during the broadcast tonight. So people worldwide are living longer. The population of those over 60 is expected to double between 2018 and 2060, according to some estimates. So what are Bay Area communities doing to prepare for that growth? What can we as individuals do to prepare for our own old age or for the old age of our loved ones? Ariana Alex and Janae Cottrell are two experts in the field of aging who will help us answer these questions and more. So let me start with Ariana Alex, the Director of Care Management Services at Sage Elder Care Solutions. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Glad you can join. And we're also joined by Janae Cottrell, the Program Manager of Marin County Aging and Adult Services. Welcome to you, Janae.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Janae, let me start with you. Can you just describe who are today's older adults, and how can we expect that demographic to change in the decades ahead based on what you're seeing?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, worldwide, there's what we call a longevity boom, and we really look at this as people 60 and older, and that segment of the population is growing across the world. In the Bay Area, we happen to have some of the oldest counties in California. And that's based on the percentage of people who are 60 and older. So, for example, in Marin County, 30% of our population is already 60 and older. And some data indicate that that percentage is going to grow to be about 38% by 2030. 2030 is when the youngest baby boomers will turn 65. So worldwide, there's about 703 million people 65 and older. Some of the data we have 65 and older, some 60 and older. So worldwide, that's 703 million 65 and older. and that will increase to about 1.5 billion by that 2030.
Well, Janae, thanks for kind of painting a picture here of where we're going. And Ariana, just to turn to you, given the number of baby boomers that are reaching their golden years, as Janae just described, I imagine that you're pretty busy as director of a care management practice. Can you explain to our listeners what that practice is exactly?
Sure. So Sage Elder Care Solutions, we offer care management, specialized home care, and a therapeutic activity program called the Hummingbird Project. The care management practice really provides consulting and management services for older adults and their families. We assess their needs. We help family understand options, guide through difficult decision-making, and arrange for the best level of care. And we could sort of help see it through to manage it ongoing.
And many of us have elderly parents or maybe approaching our later years ourselves. So when do you recommend that people should start planning for old age?
Yesterday? No. I really think it needs to be top of mind. And I think planning for old age is not something that anyone really wants to talk about. I think it's a little scary and feels far away. But I would say that it's never too soon to have discussions with your, family members or friends, whoever your network is, to really figure out, like, how does someone want to age? What's important to them? Start there. Having those difficult conversations early on when someone has the ability to to participate in that conversation, I think is really key and can really set the framework for the long run.
Well, Ariana, you mentioned these are difficult conversations, and there is a kind of a block for people to want to talk about something that seems unpleasant to think about or sort of scary to think about. Do you have any tips for how to kind of get past that mental or emotional block?
Well, I like to say start small. We don't have to talk about, how we see our very end of life, but how do we see the middle years or, the 70s, the 80s. And just to talk about, what does someone want? Do they want to be around their friends and their family? Do they want to stay in their home? Things that are easy to talk about, not things that we might be, putting off because it's worrisome.
Mm-hmm. So start small in a sense. Mm-hmm. And just curious what you think are the most important things that people should be thinking about. What are those big sort of mm-hmm. categories of topics that people should be thinking about as they plan for their loved ones' later years?
Yeah, I would say in my experience, it's really two buckets of legal and financial. mm-hmm. When I say legal, it's really thinking, do I have, my papers in order? Do I have a power of attorney? What is a power of attorney? Why would I need that? Do I have someone that could help me make medical decisions in the future if I'm not capable? And then the financial piece is really about understanding the market, understands what it means to age in place or to stay home and what are the options and making sure that either someone can plan for that financially or have that sort of impact their decision-making.
Well, and Ariana, just staying with you on this, there are a lot of different options from staying at home to nursing home. So it's hard often to know what's best. Can you offer some guidance here? Just a brief overview of what all the different options available might be.
Sure. And I think, I could probably go on and on about this, but what I can say is, there are many ways to look at it. And for me, it really depends on really what someone needs. What does someone need in order to have a good quality of life, to have their, their care needs met, and then the financial means to obtain those goals. And so it could look anything like staying at home with a companion who could help with a few things like, errands and cooking and light housekeeping. It could be an adult day program in the community, to help with social, isolation. It could be anything from full-blown home care in the home 24/7 because someone really has a skilled need to assisted living and, of course, skilled nursing in the community.
Well, and if money were no object, I mean, what do you think is kind of the best, the gold standard or what most people would want if money weren't a concern?
So I'm a little bit biased to aging in place at home, I'll admit. But I think for most people, it comes down to staying social and connected. And so I think that if money, you know, if money is no option, well, you can really, you know, you could create an experience for someone at home by being really creative with what you're bringing in. So, you know, I think at Sage Elder Care Solutions, in my role, it's really about creating a specific plan for someone. And I think some people want to be part of a communal setting and some people prefer to stay home.
And the cheapest option, what's that usually?
Well, you know, when I think of the cheapest option, I mean, you know, I think when I think of someone's level of care, so someone who has a lot of care needs, meaning they really need assistance with getting through the day, the less expensive option is probably going the skilled nursing route, but that's not always appropriate for everyone, you know, nor is it a top choice. So sometimes it's a little bit of a hybrid option where, you know, a combination of family caregivers, professional care providers, options in the community, such as adult day health or other options as well.
Yeah. I guess, you know, traditionally it was family care that probably filled this gap, I'd imagine, back in the day. Well, so let's talk about what our community as in general is doing to prepare for an older population. And Janae, I wanted to bring you back in on this. So not all people move into assisted living centers or retirement communities. In fact, according to the AARP, 77% of people 50 and older want to age in place, perhaps to Ariana's point there. So as program manager of the Marin County Aging and Adult Services, can you tell us what your agency and others in the Bay Area like it are doing to prepare for this demographic change?
Sure, certainly. We have two sides of our house, if you will, in Marin County Aging and Adult Services. The aging stands for the Area Agency on Aging. And I'll tell you a little more about that in a bit. And the adult services represents in-home supportive services, which is a Medi-Cal program for people to get care in their homes, and adult protective services. And the aging side of our house, those are all programs and services that we offer that have no means testing. So there's no, you don't have to be low income. We serve people of all income levels. And area agencies on aging, there's about 620 across the country, 33 in California, many in the Bay Area, were funded by the Older Americans Act. And the whole idea behind the Area Agencies on Aging, or AAAs, as we call them, is to help people just do that, help people to remain in their homes safely, because you're right, that's what most people want to do. Mm-hmm. So for those people who want to do that and we can help support doing that, that's what we're all about. And, you know, in the Bay Area, we have several. Most counties have their own AAA. Some in the Bay Area are combined, like Napa and Solano, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask, as I understand, the Marin County Area Agency on Aging is just one of many in the Bay Area, and you just referenced some of the other counties there. Does each county then have their own agency, and how can listeners find them?
Yeah, most counties in California do, but some, like in Napa and Solano, they go together. So they have a combined agency that serves both counties. And I think the best way for listeners to find out about their area agency on aging, their local one, is to go to the California Department of Aging's website. There is a page there called Find Resources in My County. So that way you can click on your county and you can find out, you can get the phone number for your area agency on aging. So if you go to aging.ca.gov, you can find that. Or you can also call 1-800-510-2020 and they'll tell you, they'll give you the local number for your local area agency.
Great. Thank you. We'll try to make sure that's on our State of the Bay webpage as well on our KALW website. So thank you for sharing that. I want to also ask you, Janae, just broader than the Bay Area, just from a global perspective, according to the Institute of Longevity, 50% of five-year-olds today will live to be 100 years old. So it seems like we need to re-envision what people will need to be able to live well if they're going to live to be 100 years old. And the World Health Organization has made it a priority to prepare the world for this older population. Can you tell us a little bit about that initiative and what it involves?
Right, that's right. And this all started about gosh, this started in around 2010, I believe, when the World Health Organization established what's called the Global Network for Age-Friendly Cities and Communities. And the whole idea around that was to connect different cities and communities around the world with a common vision of making all of our communities livable for people of all ages. Because when you think about it, something that's good for an 80-year-old is great for an 8-year-old too. So really, how can we look at the different areas where we live, whether it's a city, whether it's a county, whether it's a state, what can we do to improve access to all kinds of things? And what can we do to improve that so that as younger people who are expected to live even longer, how really it's almost better for younger people in a way, because if we can do this for those of us who are older now, that's going to be even better for people who can grow up in that kind of environment. So there's thousands of communities around the world that have joined this global network. Here in the U.S., the AARP actually is the affiliate, because it got to be to the point where who needed help managing this in different countries. So AARP is our affiliate in the U.S. And each of these communities they try to work in 8 different domains, and I'll read those off for you: health and community services, outdoor spaces, respect and social inclusion, mobility options, housing options, community participation, civic engagement, and communications. And in Marin, and in many actually age-friendly communities, more and more are adding disaster preparedness, especially in California. Because after what we've seen with some of the fires, that unfortunately, disproportionately, people who are older have perished in those kinds of disasters. So, you know, each age-friendly city or county looks at all these domains. Some of them may only focus on a few of them. Some of them try to do work in all of them.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you for that overview. And yeah, definitely hits home just with the extreme weather events that we've been having, what it means to make sure that our elders are taken care of. So if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing aging in the Bay Area with Ariana Alex and Janae Cottrell. Do you have an older parent or loved one? How did they fare through the isolation of the COVID-19 pandemic? What services do you wish your community could provide for them? You can join us. We'd love to get your questions for our guests by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay on Twitter, that is. So I wanted to go to a listener comment. Peter from Mill Valley asks, what do you think about long-term care insurance? Is this a wise investment? So Ariana, maybe I'll direct that one to you.
Sure. I think from my vantage point, I think it is a wise decision to be made. And I'll tell you why I think that. I would say for every 10 clients we have at Sage, about half of them have invested in long-term care insurance way before it was a popular or well-known thing to do. And those individuals are the ones now who are able to take advantage, of their policy. And we've seen it make a pretty significant impact in their ability to pay for care, I think, longer than they would have. You know, it doesn't, I think the cost of care has far outseated, what the allotment is, but it makes a huge impact. And every time someone comes across my desk who has invested in that, I'm like, yes, because it's really wonderful in the later years. We at Sage really help individuals who do, who have a policy, sort of initiate their benefits, and how do they get that granted. We really guide people through that process to make sure that they're receiving the full amount. I think it's a worthwhile endeavor if you hit it at the right time.
Yeah. And Janae, did you want to add in anything on long-term care insurance?
I'm really not as well versed on it, honestly, as Ariana is. I have, some personal thoughts about that. But I think she probably, I thought she answered that question very well. So,
all right. Okay. Well, thank you to Peter for that question. So let me ask about the pandemic. I referenced this in question for the audience. We'd love to hear from any listeners who want to talk about aging and the pandemic, because it's really taken a toll on all of us, but, especially with memories of nursing homes going on lockdown and loss of so many older citizens to the ravages of COVID. I think it really seems like it has hit the senior community the hardest. So I'm just wondering, maybe I'll start with you, Ariana, if you could describe just what you've seen in terms of the emotional and psychological cost of protecting our seniors' physical health during this COVID pandemic.
I think the older adults who have been in skilled nursing or even in assisted living communities, in my opinion, have been hit the hardest in terms of being isolated. I think early on in 2020 and for most of 2020, these were individuals who were not leaving sometimes their room because the facility was trying their best to protect them, to protect their staff. The effects that we've seen are individuals, especially who have a cognitive impairment, who really relied on, you know, an advocate or a companion or a visitor from the outside to provide them with engagement or, you know, really just to enhance their quality of life, to meet the gap of what the, you know, skilled nursing couldn't provide. And I think those are the clients we've had where we've seen a pretty big decline in their cognition and their physical health and their emotional health. I can think of a story in which we advocated really hard to get a doctor to write an order for a social worker to come in as part of a way, because there was such a, it took such an emotional toll, and it was not a good scene. And I say this knowing that people working in those communities also have gone through a very traumatic experience as well and have suffered their own, you know, I would say issues around, you know, really trying to protect the residents in their community, but it's been a really hard time. And so for me, I don't know about Janae, but I would say social isolation was really huge. And it's hard to be in the healthcare world right now. And especially in the past 2 years, I think on many levels.
Well, and perhaps not all that dissimilar, ironically, from what younger children were going through in terms of isolation, although obviously not the same physical issues. Janae, any thoughts about what you saw in terms of emotional and psychological toll for seniors during COVID?
Yes, huge. As Ariana has described, very similar, I think, to people who are living at home. And as we age, more of us will end up living alone. And in fact, in Marin County, we know that more than 40% of people age 16 older live alone. And that was before the pandemic. So when you add on what happened in the pandemic, you know, for example, people who would be quite independent and going to the grocery store or maybe meeting a friend for lunch or going on a walk with another friend, that all ended. And so suddenly, that was, and that's had, we think, some very lasting effects, because we know that social isolation is an indicator of good health and well-being. And when you are socially isolated, it does impact not only the quality of life, but your health, your emotional health, your mental health, your physical health. So certainly those were huge impacts. And, you know, I'm going to, if I can, speak a little bit about what we did in Marin County with our area agency on aging and what a lot of others did. We tried to address this. So, for example, we received some federal funding around COVID from the FCRA Act and then the CARES Act. So we used some of that funding to deliver groceries. Because we knew many older adults were scared to go to the grocery store and they were really being told to stay home at all costs, right? So we did that. We were able to pivot and allow some of the services that would normally be provided in person to be provided virtually. So, and then we have a home delivered meal program called Meals on Wheels for more frail individuals. And we typically have a congregate meal program where people can come and gather in person. So we were able to get approval from the state to switch to a grab and go, so people could still drive through and get their meals. And even that more informal connection, even that's really, really important. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we got a lot of positive feedback from individuals who are saying, I miss going to the congregate meal, but just even seeing that person saying who says hello to me when they hand me my lunch is, it means so much.
Well, that's a great example, Janae. And I'm wondering, you know, what else you could recommend? I mean, people obviously don't want to compromise their health or put themselves at risk, but what can be done? What kind of best practices would you see out there for folks who are struggling even now as the pandemic has waned a bit with that isolation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think if you have a family member, if you have a friend, if you have a neighbor who's an older adult, you know, keep them in mind, reach out to them. And that's always good to do even before the pandemic. Again, you can contact your local AAA because we provide one of the services that we provide. It's called Senior Center Activities. It doesn't have to be through a senior center, but those activities are fun, but they have a very serious purpose too. And that is to connect people. So we're doing a lot of that. We actually contract out a lot of that, and our providers are actually doing a lot of that on Zoom. Some of them have gone to a hybrid. So your AAAs can also tell you about things. There's also services called Senior Centers Without Walls, where you can talk to somebody. You can talk to someone if you're lonely. So we have all kinds of different information and resources for people who are 16 and older who might be at risk of social isolation.
All right. Well, this is State of the Bay. If you're just tuning in, we're on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing aging in the Bay Area. We'd love to hear from you if you have tips on how to overcome social isolation during this pandemic time for older citizens, or if you're caring for an elderly loved one and want to share your experience and what help you might need or what you'd recommend to others. We'd love to hear from you. You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And let's go to the phone lines. We have Peter calling in from Marin. Oh, I think we lost Peter. So if you wanted to call back in, you're welcome to. We have another listener who writes in, Bridget from Marin, who wrote, caring for an elderly loved one can be exhausting, especially if you are older yourself. Do you have any tips to help those of us providing the care? Ariana, do you want to answer that question there from Bridget?
Sure. Well, I would say, I mean, the first step is to acknowledge that someone like that is at risk for possible burnout. You know, I think there's nothing harder than providing care, but providing care for someone who you're close with. I think it's harder to set, you know, clear boundaries. And so I think it would be great for this person to be able to consult with someone on, you know, how can I create breaks for myself? How can I give myself respite? And sometimes just building that into a day or to a week is really important for the adult child or whoever, or, you know, whoever it might be taking care of the older adult. And so that's something that I would, you know, I would look to give some advice, like to see, okay, out of a whole week, is there a chunk of time when someone could come and help out with what's on the, you know, what the tasks are at hand, or can they go to a day program for a few hours during the day to give the adult child some time to, you know, to step away. You know, they're not alone in this feeling. And I think that the more that they can acknowledge that, wow, I really need to have some separation here, I think the better they'll be for it.
Yeah. So the caretakers need some care. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The caretakers need some care themselves. Janae, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yes. One of the programs that we fund is called Family Caregiver Support. And in Marin County, Jewish and Family Children's Services provides that service. You don't have to be Jewish to partake of that, but some of the services that we provide are support groups, respite care, and in many other communities, you can contact your local area agency on aging to find out, or you can call Jewish and Family Children's Services does that in other communities around the Bay Area, as does the Alzheimer's Association. So that's really important. I agree with Ariana, you know, people need a break, and there are some services. And in our case, these services are provided at no cost.
Mm-hmm. One thing that comes to mind too, is that the Alzheimer's Association has some really wonderful support groups that, I think the silver lining of the pandemic is that they've gone virtual, which I think makes it more accessible to, you know, the caretaker when they might not be able to take the time off to go somewhere. And their support groups, I have found specifically for adult children taking care of their aging parent, because they have their own niche issues and concerns and feeling of burnout. So I think that's something else to consider.
All right. And we have another listener who writes in, my grandmother is 92. She's lived alone for the last 20 years. She's fiercely independent and has no desire to move out of her home, though her ability to care for herself is declining daily. Do you encounter a lot of resistance when trying to move the elderly into assisted living situations? Ariana, thoughts on that?
I don't know how many, I think Janae and I were both probably thinking, how many times have we heard fiercely independent, you know, 95 year old, I think, it's super common, but doesn't make it any easier to tackle the issue. And, you know, my approach is always trying to think about what's the kind way, you know, what's the way to help someone that doesn't completely take away their feeling of control and all their independence. And so, you know, I think starting off with something that the person can perceive they need help with, even if they need help with like 10 or 12 or more things, like start small. I think that's like my theme. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's they really identify that they need a driver, or they really identify they need someone to run an errand. Start there. Mm-hmm. And I think the question was really around moving, and I think that's really big. You know, so I would say if they can start in a small place, you can get someone's buy-in a lot faster.
No, that's really good advice. We have just another minute or two left, but we do have a caller, Maria from Berkeley, on the line. So I want to let Maria join us. Maria, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thank you so much. And thank you to your guests. And thank you for all that you do. Since we're all getting older every moment of the day, thankfully, I wondered if anyone had explored or developed a program to have shared housing, either multiple elders living together in a home or bringing in social care people that can share the housing so that they don't have to be isolated and alone.
Yeah, great question. Janae, let me throw that one to you real quick, just very briefly, since we're just about out of time.
Yes, indeed. There's a program called Home Match that's in Marin. I think it's offered elsewhere in the Bay Area. But once again, if you look up your local area agency on aging, we all have a service called information and assistance. And if you pose that question to someone with your area agency on aging, they can let you know if there's a program like that in your local area.
All right, great. And Ariana, any last thought on that?
I think Janae is the expert here, so thank you so much.
All right, great. Well, thank you, Maria, for calling in. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but I want to thank our guests for joining us, Ariana Alex, Director of Care Management Services at Sage Elder Care Solutions, and Janae Cottrell, the Program Manager of Marin County Aging and Adult Services. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you have parents or loved ones who are in need of services, or if you might want to start planning for your own golden years, you can find a link to both of our guest organizations and more on the State of the Bay page on KALW.org. Coming up after the break, my co-host Grace Wan talks with Dick Schulze, America's oldest competitive snowboarder in the United States. So stay with us.
I think there is something about the way you move on a snowboard you feel like you're dancing with the mountain. I started snowboarding 1 week before my 53rd birthday, and then, of course, have continued ever since. I've been a competitive snowboarder for, I guess, about 23 years now.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. This is Grace Wan. You've just heard from my guest tonight, Truckee resident Dick Schulze. At 76 years of age, Schulze is the oldest competitive snowboarder in the United States, and he has been competing in amateur and professional competitions around the world for over two decades. Schulze joins me to discuss his life on the slopes. Dick, welcome to State of the Bay.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
I find this amazing that you were in your 50s when you started snowboarding. Tell us how you were introduced to the sport and what got you hooked.
Well, I was a skier for some years before that. I started skiing when my son was little, and he wanted to learn to ski, and we learned together. Well, at that time, this was in the 1980s, snowboarders had rather a poor reputation. And so we both formed sort of the typical skier of the time negative impression of snowboarding. And I thought of snowboarders as being mostly teenage boys who did not behave very well. But then one day on a chairlift, I met a fellow who was obviously well past his teen years who was snowboarding. And I commented on that, and he said that he used to ski, tried the board once, and loved it so much that he never skied anymore. Well, that got me curious, and I wanted to try it out. Now, I said that to my son, and he wanted nothing to do with it. But then he did his junior year of college at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. And so for the first time, he was out of the country, and I was taking ski trips alone. And on one of those trips, I figured, I'll try the board, I'll find out what it's like, I'll satisfy my curiosity. What I wasn't prepared for was that I loved it from about the first 2 minutes on the board, and everything just followed after that.
What was it about snowboarding that first time when you just took to it that was so different from skiing that made you fall in love with it?
Well, the sensations are very different. You know, you have different types of movements on snowboard or on skis. And there was just something about the way the snowboard moved that I found to be really very sensuous. I have one longtime snowboarding friend who said that when you're skiing, you often think of yourself as conquering the mountain. When you're snowboarding, you're dancing with the mountain. And I think that's a pretty good way to put it.
I love that. I love that. Now, you've been competing for over 20 years, and I understand that you've even competed against Shaun White at the 2006 Olympic qualifiers. What was that like?
Well, it was, of course, competing against him in the sense that, you know, we're all taking different runs in the pipe being scored by judges. Now, I've been in several events where I've competed against him. And, you know, the fact that he's one of the competitors doesn't really make it a whole lot different than what it would be if he weren't there. Because when I'm competing in the pipe, I'm doing a run through the pipe. I'm doing the best maneuvers and the best tricks I can. And I'm being scored by the judges. So it's more a question of what the pipe is like and what the weather is like than who the other competitors are. Although when it's people that I know, it does make it fun. And I've known him since he was 16.
Wow. But you're not just somebody who competes in snowboarding. You've worked part-time as an attorney, and you've also taught skiing and snowboarding. And you've said that being a snowboarding instructor was about the most personally rewarding thing you've ever done. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because I'm helping people to achieve something new and something that for many of them is very difficult. When I first started teaching, or actually before I did, I sort of would have thought that anybody who'd go to the trouble to go to a ski resort and pay for a lesson would be highly motivated. Mm. But that's not true. There are many reasons why people go. My very first day teaching one of my very first groups, a young woman at the start of the lesson, said that the only reason she was there was because her boyfriend wanted her to be. She obviously did not want to be there. Well, then it becomes to me to help her to learn some skills and to make it fun for her, which on that particular day I did. When she did her first turn, she got tremendously excited. But people have a variety of different reasons for being there. Sometimes they've been dragged along by friends, or they saw it on TV and thought it looked cool. Then they get up there and find out that it's a vigorous outdoor sport.
Yes.
And, you know, people are afraid of getting hurt. They're afraid of looking foolish in front of their peers. There are lots of different fears. And helping people to overcome those fears and to accomplish even a simple movement that for them is often very difficult, I've made a difference in their lives, and I find that to be enormously satisfying.
Well, I'm somebody who picked up skiing when I was older, and I have a tremendous fear of heights. And I'm curious, what advice might you have to a student like me?
Well, the fear of heights is a very common one, and it's equally true for skiers and for snowboarders. Mm-hmm. For many people, it comes up mostly acutely when the first time you get on a chairlift.
Oh, yeah.
The chair promptly picks you up and takes you 15 or 20 feet above the snow. And I had that at first when I first started skiing. I was terrified of the chairlift, and it took me a while to get over it. I think other than that, as far as fear of the mountain or fear of the steepness of the slope, it's working up little by little. You know, when you start out as a beginner, you're going to be on pretty much flat terrain. Now, when I'm teaching beginning snowboarders, one of the first things I will teach them is how to fall in a way that doesn't hurt. With snowboarding especially, most people never get hurt, but those who do, it's usually the wrists or the shoulders, and it comes from trying to catch yourself with your hands if you're falling down. So I show them how not to do that. Hmm. And that gives them confidence, because once they've learned just the very simple movements that can protect them from injury, that takes some of the fear out of falling. And then we move up little by little from flat terrain to very gentle slope and so forth. And I'll do it at a pace that keeps them reasonably comfortable. And the same thing is going to be true of beginning skiing. You know, you start out on flat slope and then you gradually work up little by little. And even for more advanced riders than when you're out on the mountain yourself, you know, you do first green slopes, then you work up to blues. And then when you get comfortable on those, you can work up to blacks, and then you can work up to where you're comfortable on really pretty steep terrain. Many people never do that. Many people are perfectly happy to be on a greens or easy blues, and they have a lot of fun that way. So it's partly a question of what you want to do and what you enjoy.
Well, I want you to be my instructor. I'm going to sign up.
Well, thank you.
It seems pretty inspiring. You know, at 76, are there runs that you won't take anymore, or is the whole mountain available to you?
Oh, the whole mountain is pretty much available. There are some things I don't like to do now, and those come into mostly the big jumps slope style. When I first started 20 years ago, the bigger the jump, the better I liked it. And in those first couple of years, I competed in events two or three times when I was going off 60-foot jumps. And those are pretty big. By comparison, you look at the big air that was in the Beijing Olympics. That was more than 60 feet, but not a whole lot more. And like I say, I've done those several times, and I've banged myself up several times. And as I'm getting older, I'm finding that the urge to hit those big jumps just isn't there anymore. So I generally don't do that.
Well, you were profiled in the LA Times, and the columnist who wrote the piece said that you smoked him on the mountain. So I bet you're pretty fast, Dick. I think you're pretty fast. Well, I'm really inspired by the fact that you picked up something new to you in your 50s. Obviously, you're not only good at it, you just, the glee on your face as you describe snowboarding is pretty evident. You and I are on a video call together. Tell us, you know, for people who might be inspired to try something new at a later stage of life, what advice do you have for them in terms of picking up a new sport or a hobby or an interest?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, books have been written on that. I read one just fairly recently. And
yeah.
I don't know, for advice is, first of all, I think one of the biggest things is that people later in life often are afraid if they try something, they will look foolish. Don't let that be a factor. Because everybody else who tries it has the same fear when they start out and say, hey, I want to do this. I'm going to go for it. And never mind what anybody else thinks about it. And then, of course, you know, learn something about it, get an idea of what you're going to do, and then to really just try to go for it and have fun. You don't have to reach any particular achievement or any particular level or anything. Do what you really like, and don't be afraid to challenge yourself.
Dick Schulze, it's such a pleasure to meet you, and good luck in the rest of your races.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been fun being here.
Thanks for joining us on State of the Bay.
Well, that's the State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, please visit our State of the Bay page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at any time at stateofthebay@KALW.org. Next Monday, we'll talk with Laura Bazelon as she discusses the work-life balance in her new book, Ambitious Like a Mother. That's next Monday at 6 p.m. Tonight's show was produced by Jillian Emblad and Kendra Klang. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Damian Miner was our board operator. Good night, and thanks for listening.